Pardon the interruption. I just want to tell you about a video that I want you to check out. It features the one and only Chuck Norris. You remember Chuck Norris? The man's in his 80s. And, you know, I'm no spring chicken. Nonetheless, I care about my health. I want to live a long time. I want to be healthy. I don't always get as many fruits and vegetables and herbs that are supposed to increase my energy levels in my own diet. So I saw this video that Chuck Norris has made. He's kicking butt. He's working out. He's staying active. He has heaps of energy left over for his grandkids and so on. And he says that he is achieving all this by making one single change. And he feels like he's in his 50s. Go to mymorningkick.com/Josh and watch Chuck Norris's video right now. That's mymorningkick.com/Josh, mymorningkick.com/Josh. G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. And here's a big dangerous idea that every single Australian man, woman, and child, not child, they can't vote, man and woman and other, non-man, woman, man, she, man, and one of the, all of the voting people in Australia will soon be asked, nay, required to vote on the idea that Australia should change its constitution to create a formal body in which First Nations Australians could express their will, their opinion, on bills that may come before the Parliament that affect First Nations people. This would be a very, very big deal, and it's not very often that Australia comes together to try to change its founding document, or that any country comes together to try to hold a national referendum to change its founding document. So I thought it would be time to speak to someone who understands this issue better than anyone. Jack Lattimore is the Aboriginal Affairs journalist at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper. These are the large broadsheets in Australia, and can give us the most impartial understanding of all of the people who I know of the pros and cons, the yeses and the nos, the facts and the fictions which he's been studying about this proposal. A little bit of background first. First Nations Australians are the oldest continuous civilization in the world. There are a great many different nations on the landmass and the waters and islands of Australia, and therefore it has not historically been a simple question of like, oh, let's just make a treaty necessarily. Not that there's ever been a huge push for a treaty, but to the extent that there was, it's not been like, for example, the First Nations people in New Zealand, the Māori, who are much, much more recent and much more ethnically homogenous as a people with whom one could negotiate. So we find ourselves in 2023 in a situation where you have these civilizations of kind of vast complexity and geographic diversity and ethnic and linguistic diversity across this enormous landmass. And the attempt to try to get our arms around the needs of these communities is to establish this body, the idea of which comes out of the Uluru Statement of the Heart. That was a constitutional convention which ended with this statement called the Uluru Statement from the Heart. This took place in 2017, a national constitutional convention to really try to seriously address and reckon with Australia's genocidal founding sins, and more importantly, perhaps, to actually address the disadvantage and the lived reality of what it means to be a First Nations person in Australia, which generally means that you are subjected to all kinds of disadvantage that other communities are not. You don't live as long, your water is likely to be dirtier, you're likely to have less access to healthcare, you're likely to have less access to housing. There are, across a whole number of metrics, Australia is performing woefully in terms of its treatment of Indigenous Australians. That's just a statistical kind of demographic reality that has proved incredibly intransigent for decades, for centuries, except nobody in power cared about it until decades ago. And even since they have started caring about it, their attempted remedies, as Jack will explain, have fallen short. you'll hear Jack talk about closing the gap. This is a lingo in Australia that if you're not Australian, you may not be familiar with. It's just about closing the gap between Indigenous outcomes and non-Indigenous outcomes in Australia across all of those kinds of metrics. So measurable ways of closing, for example, the gap between life expectancy and so on. So the Uluru Statement from the Heart, have a listen to it. I want you to hear Professor Megan Davis, who was a member of the Referendum Council in 2017, when they finally come together, they hammer together this statement. It's not very long. It's a few minutes long, 3 or 4 minutes long. They hammer together this statement that basically encapsulates the past, present, and future of how they see First Nations people in Australia. Here's Professor Megan Davis for the first time in history on the floor of the First Nations Constitutional Convention in 2017.
The Uluru Statement from the Heart. We, gathered here at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did, according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion. The ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom remain attached thereto and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise that peoples possessed a land for 60 millennia and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionally, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are aliened from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement-making between governments and First Nations and truth-telling about our history. In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country, and we invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future.
So there you have it. Professor Megan Davis, a member of the Referendum Council, reading out the Uluru Statement from the Heart for the first time on the floor of the First Nations Constitutional Convention in 2017. And you will have heard her say, "We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution." A voice. Meaning, in practice, a formal body which will have First Nations representatives on it, which will make representations to Parliament. It can be overruled, right? This, in fact, I'll read to you now what we're actually voting on in this referendum. So the referendum question on October 14th will be, you'll have to say yes or no to this question. A proposed law to alter the Constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. Do you approve this proposed alteration? And you will say yes, or you will say no. That's all it'll say on the referendum. Now, what's the actual amendment? How would the Constitution actually be changed? So the insertion, the phrase that would be inserted into the Constitution would read as follows. Chapter 9, Recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples. 129, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Voice. And it would say, in recognition of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander peoples as the First Peoples of Australia, and then it'll list 3 points. One, there shall be a body to be called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. Two, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice may make representations to the Parliament and the Executive Government of the Commonwealth on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Three, the Parliament shall, subject to this Constitution, have the power to make laws with respect to matters relating to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice, including its composition, functions, powers, and procedures. So that's the amendment. Point one says we bring into being this body of First Nations people, and we're calling it the voice. Point two says if that body wants to, it can make representations, recommendations, advice to two of the branches of government, the Parliament and then the Executive, on matters relating to First Nations Australians, right? And then point three is that the Parliament is still the body that has the power to figure out what the voice is, right? The voice doesn't have any power to decide how many people it has or how what constitutes it or how much it gets paid or whatever. Point three says the Parliament has the power to make laws regarding that thing. Now, you will note in none of those three points does it say anything about the Parliament or the Executive being obliged to listen to the voice. It just says that there's going to be a body called the voice. The voice may make representations to the government about issues that affect First Nations people, and that the Parliament will have the power to make laws about this body. But it can't get rid of the body because the body's establishment is in the Constitution. That's what we're voting on. Now, nothing is simple, especially when it comes to difficult issues like race. And so it has gone initially, perhaps back in sort of 2017 at the time of the Constitutional Convention, from being a question of like, here is our request as Indigenous people, please, citizens of goodwill in Australia, come along with us and follow us into the future. And it has changed from that into, well, maybe the voice isn't enough. Maybe it's too much. Maybe we as First Nations people actually should be asking for things that are more detailed and on the ground, like improvements in conditions and closing the gap, rather than this bureaucratic body that could get co-opted by special interests anyway. Or maybe why are we bothering with a bureaucratic body when the whole artifice of Parliament and the Executive and the Australian state are all founded on the blood of genocide anyway, and they haven't recognised sovereignty officially, and we should really have a treaty. And it's becoming a cacophony. It's becoming an unhelpful cacophony. And I just want you to listen to Jack and anyone else who you want to listen to who is measured and well-informed about this. I'm not proposing a particular position one way or another on whether this referendum is a good idea or a bad idea. I just want whatever the decision that people make to be one that is based on reason and not based on bullshit. So without further ado, please enjoy the one and only Jack Lattimore. Can you take us back, Jack, before to sort of what led to the voice to Parliament in the first place? Because there'll be some people listening to this who are super in the weeds of it, and then some people who might live abroad who are hearing about it for the first time. What's the genesis of it?
How far do you want to go back? It's really the question to answer that question.
Some less than 60,000 years.
Okay, yeah, all right. No, don't have to go that far. But look, it's been around the thinking of it and various forms of a representational body. It's been there for at least, 67 definitely.
1967 was the last referendum that dealt with this issue.
Well, it didn't deal with this issue. That was a different subject matter.
I guess the question of Australia's posture towards its First Nation people.
Yeah, around that period, there were bodies like FICATSI, and I don't know the acronym, so don't ask me to pull that one apart. But it was, Aboriginal Advancement or Aboriginal Rights Advancement Group, but it was largely steered by, white fellas. So from about 67, we start to see self-determination, which went by, black power, same thing, same, really, arrive in Australia and Aboriginal people begin to take hold of the wheel and, of these sorts of organisations. And then you had a number of these representational bodies come up. None of them were enshrined. That's the big difference. None of them were enshrined in the Constitution, but there was a succession of them, and they'd swap and change with each incoming government. Early 70s, after Whitlam sort of brought in, that's considered to be the start of the self-determination period, and that continued as known as the, or recognised as the self-determination period for some decades and really kind of only changed when we're looking at, the reign of John Howard coming in, I would say. Periods before that were like protectionist periods, assimilation periods. So there's a few that are kind of.
And what changed during the Howard government? So that was for non-Australians. John Howard was a long-serving conservative prime minister who served during the, I guess it overlapped mostly with the George W. Bush administration in the United States. What changed towards First Nations Australians then?
They weren't real keen on self-determination very much. There was a body called ATSIC, which is Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Commission, I think. ATSIC. That was a representative body, democratically elected to some extent. And kind of it's tricky to get a bead on exactly how it was, whether there was goodwill towards it from the Aboriginal community I'm talking about. You kind of get a range of opinions across the spectrum there, but generally speaking, it was considered a good thing and useful. But the Howard government went about dismantling it over a period until it finally, with the support of the Labor government, needs to be added, pulled the pin on it in, I want to say, 2004. And from that point on, and ATSIC was kind of like the last one of that succession of representational bodies that I talked about before. You did have the Congress, National Congress of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders that came later, but same, but different. But with pulling the pin on ATSIC, that really started to get Aboriginal people thinking that one of these bodies needed to be developed, established in a way that it couldn't easily be knocked over by any incoming government, and that is enshrining it in the Constitution. So the thinking, the most current thinking, probably goes back to about then. And then with, if you jump ahead a few years, around 2010, I think it was, with Gillard coming in, she asked, well, she appointed an expert panel to explore a number of things around constitutional recognition. Some of the things they explored involved this Indigenous voice idea. And then between 2011 through to the present, there was like a succession of reports, expert panels, joint select committees investigating the idea. So, yeah, it's been around. It's safe to say that this proposed model of the Indigenous voice has been thrashed around to and fro for over 15 years, probably getting closer to 20.
And, Jack, this idea of let's just look at the end of ATSIC for a moment, because it'll be helpful in people understanding the rationale behind doing this as a referendum and a constitutional amendment rather than through legislature. So the criticism of, and just to fact check myself, John Howard was PM from 96 to 2007. ATSIC abolished in 2004, but actually, well, the law was passed in 2004 and it was abolished in 2005.
That sounds right.
At the time, there was criticism that this had become a very bureaucratic kind of centralized Canberra bureaucracy that didn't address aspirations of First Nations people in regional Australia. Was there truth to that criticism, or do you regard that as a fig leaf for getting rid of it?
No, we're seeing the same thing now, that same rhetoric now as what they deployed back then. And also surrounding the period where it was abolished. Similarly to today, it could be argued there was a lot of disinformation around it being a corrupt body as well. None of those accusations and allegations are founded in fact. None of them. And in terms of it being a bureaucratic, encumbrance, it varied. It was no more or less than other bodies or other organisations that were similar in size and nature to what it did. But, the Howard government had it in for the idea of this body and potentially, possibly, some of the characters that were prominent on it in its last days. They kind of, went about dismantling it over months, years, until it got to the point where, they pulled the pin on it. It was missed when it was gone. I remember being in community probably around, when was that? It was before I went to uni. So it would have been 91, 92. And it was considered favourably within those communities and had community leaders within those communities excited, enthusiastic about running as candidates. Going back in the recesses of my mind to remember some of this stuff, but it was esteemed, put it that way. If it wasn't high regard, it was considered to have some esteem about it. At the end, there was so much, I'll describe as disinformation floating about in the media, and parliament, that, it construed an image of it that was sticky enough to remain in the thinking of a lot of people. And as I said, none of the accusations and allegations about it ever proved to be true.
I mean, I don't know what accusations or allegations. We'd have to go through a litany, and I'm not interested in focusing on ATSIC that much. But just for the listener to be aware, there was a review that was commissioned by the Howard government in 2003. I don't know the authors of that review, John Hannaford, Jackie Huggins, Bob Collins, and it recommended that more control should be given back to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the regions. The Indigenous Affairs Minister at the time, Amanda Vanstone, said that that review, you know, basically shows that ATSIC hadn't been connecting well with Indigenous Australians and wasn't serving them well. So we could pick it apart bit by bit, but there was a certain level of suspicion, not just among the government, but also among the people doing that review and among some Indigenous Australians themselves, about whether ATSIC was doing the best job that it could.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you got different communities that had representatives on it, and some of those communities probably felt that other communities were being heard more by the board or by the, you know, the thrust of ATSIC. So, you know, you're always going to get that. Doesn't matter what organisation, what complexion of the organisation either.
So now this rationale for a representative body comes about, and what and is can you articulate for us what your understanding of the no campaigns are before we get to the yes?
Well, I mean, yes, I can. I mean, if we go with what is beginning to be called from some people, far be it from me to come up with these sort of things, but the elite no campaign, these are the terms that researchers are putting to it in their research. Their concern around it is, well, where do you want to start? I mean, lack of detail.
Well, why don't we start?
They keep going on about lack of detail.
Why don't we start with the two? There are, correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand it, broadly sort of two no's within First Nations Australians that strike me as almost being opposite critiques. One represented by people like Senator Lydia Thorpe, another represented by people like Senator Jacinta Price. And we can deal with the sort of white Australia objections to the referendum as well if you want later, but I'm more interested in your insights into where those two positions are coming from. Is that a way to frame it?
Look, it could be. I mean, there are claims that Lydia has claimed herself that she leads a black sovereignty movement. That black sovereignty movement doesn't exist as a cohesive movement. No, I don't think that has been established as clearly as what it probably needs to be. You know, there's certainly Aboriginal people, just put aside Lydia Thorpe, there's certainly Aboriginal people in different communities out there that have what I would describe as legitimate apprehensions around a government policy, you know, stop. You know, full stop. But when it comes to voice, they are sceptical because of, you know, past experiences of government policies, hoodwinking or attempting to hoodwink, you know, their aspirations and rights. Some of that is rooted in, you know, well, basically to go with the rhetoric from some of these groups that describe themselves as black sovereignty groups, which again you'd kind of got to look at a little bit more critically, because when they talk about sovereignty, there's different understandings of what sovereignty is, and that's kind of elusive in the conversation as well, a bit like chasing smoke. But yeah, just, you know, in general, there are groups out there that are concerned that things like land justice should be more at the forefront than things like a voice. But, you know, these are views on who should be heading up or, you know, on representative of Aboriginal areas and communities at the expense of other identities that, you know, And so there's a fair bit of imported conspiracist thinking that has informed some of those groups, and I'm thinking in particular of sovereign citizen type conspiracy theories that, you know, a constitutional, I mean, this is a topic that we could stagger through for hours and none of it would be any clearer. And some of it
have is, you listened to this show? I do tend to have a habit of staggering through topics for hours and getting nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, this is there's so many warren holes when you go.
Well,
down
let me
this
here's avenue. A let me get let me throw one case study at you that I thought was interesting. It it was an ABC report from Ghana, and one of the characters who they were interviewing about the voice is this young bloke named Ben, who was he's a First Nations Aussie, and he was an enthusiastic voice supporter, and now he's a hard no. Well, he was a reluctant supporter, and now he's a hard no. And he says this, he says, quote, "It's not born out of black ambition. It's born out of what's acceptable for constitutional conservatives. The idea that the people who stole this land and then who directly benefited from it are now going to have a referendum to think about recognising the people they stole it off is insane." He says, they say it's a first step. Like, how mediocre is that for 235 years plus of brutal subjugation? It's not, and we don't have time. And he says, you know, and then the reporter says, I mean, sure, you may say that the referendum is too small and too slow and a distraction from recognising the inherent rights of First Nations people that would underpin ongoing sovereignty. But the reporter says a no vote would, you know, would set it back. And he says he doesn't think so. He says, you know, like a bushfire will come through and it'll ravage the entire scene. But you come back to that site 6 months later and you see that green bursting through. That is as good an articulation as I've heard of that side of no. Yeah, right. What do you make of it?
It's rubbish. And I know Ben. Seen him up at Ghama. Had a chat and all that. So, you know, there's nothing personal in my assessment of that view, but it doesn't stand up. And I'm not advocating for or against, but just purely in terms of, you know, a vote in the referendum, but purely on what is most likely interpretation or perspective on what will unfold in either scenario. If the referendum is unsuccessful, there will be no other opportunity to establish a representative group, a representative body, in similar nature to what is being proposed. And it won't be for decades. And if, you know, it's a worn track now, but if we look back to 99 with the Republic referendum, that fell over for whatever reason. You don't even have to go in there, but it fell over and it hasn't been revisited yet. So it's generation. If we consider a generation to be 20 years or whatever, it's a generation before you'll ever see anything remotely come around, maybe. But it does.
I mean, I remember, Jack, sorry to interrupt, but I remember during the Republic referendum having an argument with a fellow Republican. I was at uni at the time, and she was saying, well, you know, because she wanted a popularly elected president. She didn't like this model, but she was a Republican. And, you know, I don't know if you remember, the slogan for the No campaign was, let the people have their say, meaning, like, you know, let's have another kind of republic. You don't need this elite republic. Let's have one where the people have their say. She said, you know, it'll come around. She was like, you know, give it, it's inevitable. Give it, you know, another 3 years, 5 years, we'll just do it again.
Yeah, doesn't work like that.
Doesn't work like that.
And I think that's a lot of people that I've heard express, you know, the kind of buy into that we'll do it again. They are younger, and I don't think they were, you know, of a conscious age, if that's a term, in 99. Mm. So they're not coming from, you know, that sort of experiential background when they talk about it. But it's like you're not going to see anything else. And Dutton suggesting that there'd be, you know, another referendum done better if he wins the next election. I don't think there's any substance to that. And I mean, it was a bad look.
The leader of the Conservative opposition party in Australia, who's on the right wing of the right wing party. And the idea that they would be enthusiastic about picking up this baton after it fails is
like a referendum. Surprised. Referendum 2.0. It's not going to work. And it was also a bad look because his captain's pick appointed shadow spokesperson for essentially Aboriginal affairs in Jacinta Price. Was massive on the idea and was vocal about that. So it was a bad look for the no vote campaign, I thought, over the last week or 10 days or whatever it's been. But it's not going to happen, getting back to the point. And I don't think anything else would come around, whether it be, in any other form. And there's been a lot of different model options, I guess.
What about a treaty, Jack? I mean, one side of one argument on this side of the First Nations No campaign is, well, the referendum might fail and you might not get another referendum, but where is it cast in stone that you need a referendum? Mm. Why can't we have a treaty?
Yeah. It's weird, that one. In Victoria, we've kind of had the benefit of observing the treaty process, the Victoria treaty process. Where's the best place to start? I guess this is the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, which is, again, a democratically elected representative body. It started 3-4 years ago. In the electoral process, which is overseen by the Victorian Electoral Commission, VEC, they didn't have a massive turnout by standards that, the broader public ballots may have. But it was a starting point. And the most recent elections, this body is in its second iteration now, as of, I think it was April or May. At this point, for those elections, they got a larger turnout. So it's kind of steadily building. Aboriginal people aged 16 and above can vote, so it's kind of recognising that there's a broader population base that's younger, so they're involved. But it's gradually climbing in terms of the participation number.
How are these people participating, Jack? What are they?
Just by voting, just by enrolling and voting. Initially, the numbers didn't look great, but the way that you couldn't sort of scrutinise them through the same lens as you would a broader ballot, like a state election or a federal election or whatever.
Yeah, right. And what are they voting for? How does that relate to a treaty?
Well, they vote for representatives from areas, and these representatives then form part of the membership of the assembly body. Now, for the first 4 years, the assembly body was to establish the guidelines for a treaty, for a treaty structure, to put all the furniture in place. And then with this second iteration of the body, which will sit for 3 or 4 years now, their role is to negotiate a statewide treaty. We're talking about, there's going to be a number of treaties, but a statewide treaty will be negotiated by this assembly, this democratically elected body. So when I hear people say, don't matter about the referendum, don't matter about the voice, we'll just go straight to treaty, my natural sort of response is, well, who's going to negotiate that? And they go, we'll just nominate some people from different areas. And I go, okay, what do you end up with there? Oh, a group of people, what's that called? Sounds a lot like the voice. And, that's just common sense, isn't it? Who's going to negotiate the treaty? Like, we're talking a national treaty, nationwide treaty. Who's going to negotiate that?
Weren't there a series of steps that were kind of signed off on during the Uluru statement that said that you do the voice first and you have the body and then you progress towards a treaty?
Yeah, that was the thinking that came from the Uluru statement. And I think that was rooted in some logic or rationale that's in that restorative justice kind of approach to things that's worked internationally. They didn't just pull it out of thin air. pretty sure that it was modelled on a number of, you know, case studies internationally. But, you know, it's, as I said, it's common sense. Someone's got to negotiate a treaty. So whoever or whatever you form or model that's going to negotiate that treaty, that's starting to look a lot like what, you know, this model is suggesting is called the Voice.
Right. And, yeah, I must say I am always baffled by the idea that if the referendum fails, you'll be more likely to proceed to a treaty than if it succeeds. Like, yeah, well, it's a misunderstanding of human psychology, I think, and of just of the institutional inertia that exists in political systems and in cultures.
Well, with, you know, as I said, with the benefit of having observed the process thus far in Victoria, it's not just the establishment of that representative body that's called the Assembly here. It's all the pieces of furniture that were put in place over the past 4 years or so. They probably were in train much longer than that. So they're not even going to start or weren't able to start negotiating a statewide treaty until they could establish more equal footing for, you know, that Aboriginal, let's just say Aboriginal people, to negotiate with the state, because there was a power imbalance there on, you know, large proportions, whether it be financial resources or just, you know, power structure, power imbalance. You know, communities just not having the organisation to understand what they wanted to negotiate, for starters, let alone, you know, the pragmatic way of doing it. So things like the treaty, what is it, the strategic SFD, I think the acronym is, Strategic Negotiation Fund or something like that. So, you know, it was established, and then there was the Treaty Negotiating Authority or the Treaty Authority, and it's kind of like this independent umpire, they describe it as, that's kind of going to oversee the statewide treaty negotiations and then all of these nation negotiations for these smaller treaties. So you can't just, like, and this obviously takes, one, you need resources to be able to establish these things, and time is a resource. So you're not just going to leap, you know, referendums down, you beauty, you know, next year we're going to go straight to treaty. Just going off the Vic model, it's 4 to 5 probably longer years anyway, before you even start to do these things. And this is the main point out of all of the conversations around this. Over that time period, you've got people in a disadvantage, like the worst disadvantaged communities in Australia, like legit just, you know, actually dying from things that could be remedied with better policy, with, you know, advice around better shaping policy, better implementation of policy, better resourcing of, you know, health services, things like that. Like the status quo that, and, you know, this is coming out of the mouths of Yes advocates as well, the status quo that's in place hasn't, you know, served Aboriginal people and their aspirations and rights very well at all. Mm. And, you know, that's reflected in the disparity within the, you know, closing the gap measures. So, you know, I think that's the urgency around the Voice that is most central, most core and key. People are dying at the moment, and if you get a Voice in, you know, people are dying from all sorts of things, shitty water, you know, housing overcrowding and housing unavailability of housing in some of these communities, that's contributing to all sorts of dysfunction and, you know, harm in terms of health. Like you can just go through and name off your fingers. But, you know, a Voice can provide insight, useful advice to implement, well, to shape policy and then implement systems that improve these things and alleviate those you know, pressures or whatever. And people will, their life will improve, their life, the length of their life, the standard of their life, their well-being overall will improve sharply. And by, you know, whatever decisions go around delaying, you know, putting that kind of mechanism or establishing that mechanism, you know, it's going to take time and time Jack, these people don't have.
When you say that this body will improve, will rapidly increase the pace of improvement of real people's lives, that's the point at which I think the opponents of the referendum from the other perspective would jump in. Because so far we've been addressing this question of, oh, it doesn't go far enough, the voice referendum. We should go straight to a treaty. You know, it's tokenistic. It's just the white man within the institutions of the Constitution, you know, within the systems of oppression, throwing a bone that is convenient rather than going all out and actually recognising the sovereignty of First Nations. Then the other sort of almost opposite no position seems to be, rather than it not going far enough, the referendum actually goes too far because it's divisive, and it doesn't treat us all equally by addressing people on a needs basis. That we actually, instead of funding all of these, you know, bureaucrats in Canberra having a talk fest about Indigenous issues, what we need is for that money instead to be spent on bread and butter matters and funneled directly into regional Australia and helping First Nations people on the ground. How do you know that the voice, that this new body will expedite an improvement in conditions on the ground?
Well, if we're looking at the model that seems to be, and I'd have to go back to check to see if Albo has actually said this is the model that we're looking at, but the model that seems to be the one they have in mind for this voice proposal is the one that was put forward by the Tom Carmer and Marcia Langton in their final report to the last government, which was a coalition government. And the coalition government, you know, just by the side, by the way, they were pretty wrapped with it and looking towards implementing some of the early stages of it before they got turfed out at the federal election. So they were big on it then, and now they're not big on it. But if you look at that model, this is, and actually, like, as a journalist and as an Aboriginal man, this is the bit about the voice that I found most interesting. Now it's more to do with the information warfare and disinformation. Back a few months or weeks ago, it was around this detail. It is fed from local communities upwards. So this whole rhetoric, propaganda around it's going to be stuff with Canberra bureaucrats getting fat on bloody lunches or whatever. It's not true, completely inaccurate. The model that was put forward that seems to be the one that's being embraced by Albanese, fed up from local communities, and also these bodies, these local voices, are formed differently. This is a really interesting aspect to me. So some of them may be formed, say, for example, like the Victorian, well, the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, which is democratically elected, and what I would suggest is, you know, orthodox kind of way that to, you know, Western thinking in terms of elections. Others may be appointing local voices like the Dilak Council up in Arnhem Land that we heard about at Garma, where they're, you know, it's chieftains, local chieftains from clans and stuff that form this elders council. It's called the Dilak Council. The really interesting one is Torres Strait Islanders. So they would have two local voices that fed upwards into this national voice. One of them would be based on the islands, be representative of people still on the Torres Strait Islands. And another Torres Strait Island local voice would be representative of the diaspora that is based predominantly around Cairns, but elsewhere in northern Queensland. So they'd have kind of two representative bodies, because obviously the concerns of the diaspora may be a little bit different than the concerns of the people on the islands. So that's pretty cool. Or it's, you know, if it's, don't think it's cool, it's at least interesting. somewhere else may have a completely different way that I haven't even thought about. The other interesting thing to point out is that a lot of these local voices are already established, like the Dilak Council. Central Land Council is another one that you pretty much, and I'm not sure they would do this, but they could if there was an issue in the future around, you know, establishing some of these things in terms of resourcing. They could, you know, Central Land Council has representatives from, and I forget the number, but a lot of different communities and homelands that form up the Central Lands Council. So, but all of these things, all of these councils, all these smaller local bodies, they're hearing about the concerns, issues that are impacting people, you know, in community. And then those, they're carrying those concerns and issues up and over and down to Canberra. And also the makeup of that voice body in Canberra, the national voice body, isn't fixed, like it's changing. And this is all in the detail of this report, which is available online. I don't know some of the rhetoric that's out there, that no details available is just completely, you know, wrong because it's all there. And then,
right, but yeah. isn't it still to be determined whether or how those representatives will be selected? I mean, do we know whether they'll be? Yeah.
Well, it depends on each local voice or local body. You know, in some cases, it's more pertinent for customary law to inform who gets appointed. In some cases, for these local bodies, it might be more pertinent for a more Western ballot to take place. That's why it's difficult to convey to a broad public exactly what form or system it's going to take, because
you've got very different populations in very different geographies around the massive landmass.
That's right.
And so sorry.
And the other important thing is it's not fixed. None of it is fixed in terms of the design principles or concepts. This is about a starting point rather than an end point. So just may start doing it in one way. Another government comes in and says that's not really working as effectively as it could. We're going to establish it so it works like this. The voice body has to, because it's up to the government about how it is structured and how it operates. It's just that the government can't get rid of it entirely. It could change every, what was the federal one, 3 years, 3.5 years or whatever.
And Jack, one of the things that I hear most from my radio listeners who fret about it, they'll say things like, well, we don't know how many people this is going to be. We don't know what their compensation is going to be. We don't know how large the body is going to be. Like that, they're like, we're being asked to whether or not we want to order from a particular restaurant, but we haven't seen the menu yet.
Yeah. It's funny how most of the reservations that people have come back to, are they going to get paid for being on this body? And will these Aboriginal people seek reparations, which is more money? Why should they have money? And it's just, that fear or anxiety or whatever it is that drives that sort of thinking always comes into play around these issues. I don't get it, because if you're going to work every day, you get paid, don't you?
Yeah, but to be fair, to be as fair as possible to the people who have reservations, it would make a difference if there were 1,000 people in this thing earning $1 million a year versus if there were, 50 people making $100,000 a year.
You could take, in terms of the detail that's available, it's two representatives from each local body that go into the national body, gender balance as well. I forget the final makeup of the national body. But the detail is in that report. And in terms of the local bodies, again, they could look like a Dilak council, which has got, say, just off the top of my head, 8 different lead or chieftains, or whatever is the best term for that, clan leaders. It could look like the Cape York Council of Elders, which has got, again, off the top of my head, fucking 6, 8, I don't know. Or it could look like Central Land Council, which has more than that. But out of any of those local voices, you got 2 going into the national voice. In terms of wages and stuff, I don't think there is detail in the report that I've seen around that. Presumably it'd be above, you know, award wages, but it wouldn't be excessive because whatever budget it would be coming out of, you know, the overall Indigenous Affairs budget, I imagine, and like the urgency here is to use that resource into improving you know, policies or programs on the ground. So you wouldn't be taking from that pile to, you know, rob from the other pile.
And as you said, you know, the successive governments are going to be able to change all of these parameters. The one thing they're not going to be able to do is get rid of this body. That's another thing that I hear from people who are concerned. Like, why do you have to bake it into the very constitution of the nation? Well,
that's an easy one. Like, that's at the core. And that is, it goes back to the, you know, at the top of our conversation. There's been so many of these representative bodies that just get scrapped, you know, with a stroke of a pen by incoming governments. And it can be just that political, you know, partisanship that they don't like what was established by the last government, what that government represented, so they'll scrap them. That's what it feels like to Aboriginal people.
Right. I mean, so the downside of having a body like the Voice to Parliament, which is which would be legislated instead of in the Constitution, would be that the fickle whims of a partisan, you know, political hack could be inflicted upon it and it could be abolished. But the upside of not having it in the Constitution is that if it were to become useless, corrupt, pointless, misguided, co-opted by special interests, unrepresentative in some way, then you could take it out the back behind the shed and do it in, which is something that you can't do if you've put it into the Constitution. Is there any, what do you say to people who have a concern about that?
Well, it's not based in reality or fact is probably more accurate.
It is based in the fact that you can't take it out of the Constitution.
That's right. You can't take it out of the Constitution. But if those concerns that you just put forward there were legitimate, what the incoming government can do is restructure what the Voice is. So if, you know, in whatever scenario it may be, the incoming government can shape the makeup of the Voice. So it can address a lot of concerns that it may have around the Voice. Now, they can't scrap it entirely. It has to be there, but they can change the structure of it.
So what's the best yes case?
Well, the best yes case that I've heard, and I've heard, you know, I've travelled around a fair bit talking with people in community for pretty much a fair bit of Australia now. And it's what I, you know, the most common sort of response is an aspirational yes from Aboriginal people. A lot of people, you know, don't know the detail of it. You know, we asked a series of questions to kind of, you know, to get a picture of what the thinking is and the situation is for people when it comes to this proposal. And although, you know, they were like a lot of non-Indigenous communities, they were saying, where's the detail? We'd like to see more detail. It was like, when we got down to it, how would you vote? They go, well, of course I'd vote yes. Like, why would I vote no? Like, so that's what I came to describe as an aspirational yes. They wanted something to be representative of their concerns. And why would they vote against anything that endeavoured to further their aspirations or to further their rights? So I think that was the most compelling case for me personally. I kind of approached it as, you know, a journalist probably should in, you know, impartial and objective and all that sort of stuff. And the more I heard those sorts of responses, it was like, who am I to kind of stand and to oppose that sort of thinking? And these is also, you know, coming from elders, and if they weren't elders, they were older community members. So yeah, that for me, that was the most compelling. But again, with the benefit of having observed how the Vic Treaty process, as sort of developed. It's not, you know, I've said it earlier, it's not an end point, it's a starting point. So it may work, you know, starts on day one if it gets up, is and will be, you know, 3 or 4 years down the track. Well, structurally it could look different, but also it's not about, you know, implementing something and then it not changing anymore. I think a lot of it's just going to facilitate more good. This is my personal belief now, currently. It would facilitate more good than it would create problems.
What do you make politically of the multicultural question about getting multicultural communities on board? I've spoken with people who work with Chinese Australian small business people in the southwest of Sydney, for example, who are a bit baffled and confused by the whole thing and feel like, I thought this was a multicultural country where everyone's treated equally. You try to create a level playing field for everybody, but everybody can get ahead. We don't pick favorites. We're against racism and so on. And yet here's this one community that gets its special carve out. Where's the carve out for the Chinese people or the Sikh people or the young Muslim girls or whatever that might be?
Oh, well, the myth of the level playing field needs to be busted. I mean, these are national narratives that have, you know, been propagated by successive governments for decades. So the fact of the matter is Aboriginal people are not on a level playing field. And again, you'd look at the disparity in so many of the closing the gap measures. Hasn't been a level playing field since forever. So, you know.
Right, but I mean, presumably the Chinese Australian who arrives with nothing, or the Vietnamese person who arrives with nothing, or the young lesbian Muslim girl who's living with a disability, these are all people who are disadvantaged. And to the extent that there is no level playing field, all of these people feel that one has to construct a society in which all of those people are treated, if not equally, then aspirationally the same way, and that this idea of a voice to parliament runs counter to that egalitarianism in Australia.
Well, they may hold those fears, but it's not running counter to the egalitarianism. It is addressing that disparity. It's creating an even playing field. So if you have people in those scenarios that you suggested come in, and they, you know, for whatever reason, their whole community was affected in the same ways that we see entire Aboriginal communities affected by things like lack of drinking water, overcrowding in housing, culturally, you know, well, health services that are non-existent, all of those measures that we see, they would have governments prepared to do something to improve that situation. That is not the case with Aboriginal community. While the government endeavours to improve the situation and close those gaps, it, you know, has failed to do so. Even if we just go back to 2008, was it 2008 when the idea for closing the gaps kind of came up, and they started to monitor them. And there's been a number of reviews about how the method and measures about what's successful and what's not, shifting the goalposts between 2008 and the present. But even if we just go back to that stage, it demonstrates that the government fails to successfully address many and most of these issues. Now, across that period, we've seen the establishment of the Coalition of Peaks, which is a body of community-run or community-led organisations advising governments. And just that example proves that things get better when Aboriginal people are heard onto these issues, whether it's the shaping of the policy or implementing the policy, operating some of these systems in community. So with that model there, there's no reason for the government to sort of say, well, it doesn't work, because clearly it does. It needs to be, you know, bolstered up to the next stage of having a national body that can do that. It's more representative than the Coalition of the Peaks.
And so in your view, this is really about a pragmatic way of addressing concrete needs, because I also hear the argument that there is something unique about First Nations people on this continent, and they basically have a right on the basis of their enduring heritage, legacy, sovereignty on this land to be treated differently from any other group. But it sounds like you're saying that if it were the case that, for example, Somali refugees had the same persistent, entrenched, like metrics of disadvantage as First Nations Australians do, then there would be a legitimate case for having a constitutionally enshrined body of Somali refugees advising government.
Well, it would not necessarily need to be constitutionally enshrined in that instance. I mean, a lot of these lobby groups that exist currently and shape policy, shape rollout of policy, they have various interests of various communities, as their motivation or as their guiding principle. These things exist. Aboriginal people don't have one of those lobby groups. Like, I'm talking about Aboriginal communities don't have those lobby groups operating within the halls of parliament. So this is one, one way of addressing that lack of, that gap as well.
Mm. Why has it been so hard to close the gap?
Well, general answer is that the people that are developing the policy and implementing the policy and rolling out the policy within communities don't listen to the advice of the Aboriginal people that are from those communities. And that's,
is that advice given with a single voice? Because one concern is sometimes, well, who's doing the talking? If these are communities where there are high rates of dysfunction, whether it's domestic violence or disadvantage or a lack of education, then on whose behalf are the people who are speaking for them speaking? You know, there's sometimes conflicting advice.
There is conflicting advice within community, as with all communities. I'm thinking more along the lines of big policy that comes in is not guided with the best interests of Aboriginal people in mind some of the time. Other policies that do come in with the best interests and well-being of Aboriginal people in front of mind or in the first instance come in, are implemented, elements of them don't work. It becomes apparent to communities pretty quickly. Who do they tell? They've got no one to tell. It doesn't get carried, back up the chain. And these sorts of things stay in place for, say a decade or two decades, and they're harming communities. But it's generally, in many instances, a pretty simple fix or adjustment, or a simple adjustment are the things that these communities are kind of recommending, and they don't get heard. Some of the big ones, you have non-Indigenous people come up with these ideas, write a paper. We've seen this in the past with the Abbott government, write a paper, and these things, some of the people that write these papers aren't even involved in government. They are business interests. And the next thing you have, employment policies go into place, or initiatives like, the debit cards, which, over again a couple of decades was proved to be more harmful on communities than what it was beneficial, broadly speaking, not in every case. So it's that sort of thing. So in that hypothetical, we have a businessman perhaps develop a paper and then the government adopt that paper as policy, you would have a group of people on hand to say, oh, yeah, look, that's not a bad idea, but, you know, that bit there, not great. You know, there's a better way of doing it. Have a listen to this. We've got a proposal around this other bit over here. Like, that's how it would function. That's, you know, how it's likely to function, just looking at the way that the assembly is in operation down here.
You mentioned, Jack, in the early 90s when you were starting out, what would you think if you fast-forwarded 30 years? If I could show you Australia today, would you be pleased or displeased about the progress we've made on First Nations issues?
So, hang on, I've lost track. So if we're in 1992 or whatever, we're in, and fast-forward...
Yeah, we're in... In the early 90s, yeah.
look, I was still having I was only a very young man, 17 or something, 16, 17. I was having arguments with people about, you know, being called Aboriginal. Like, they would just they wouldn't call you, you say, for example, you know, you can call me Guri. Like, Guri is probably more accurate than referring to me as Indigenous or Aboriginal. Those sorts of arguments or conversations, people just didn't back then. And I, this was in an area where there was a large population of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders and other islanders as well. But non-Indigenous people just had less of an idea even how to address Aboriginal people. So in that respect, it's improved. I think over the last 10 to 15 years, it's got better in some ways. But, I mean, again, you keep going back to some of the disparities and disadvantages and stuff, and it has improved greatly. Forget 92, it hasn't improved much since 72.
Mm. There's a very noticeable... I don't want to get myself in trouble here, a very noticeable shift among white self-congratulatory elites in the amount of mental space that First Nations Australians occupies. I've noticed it over the course of my growing up, that the rise of acknowledgements of country, the sort of performative patting ourselves on the back for being deeply concerned about First Nations issues, the flying of the flag, and now signalling our virtuousness for being behind the voice referendum. They all create a sort of a matrix or a fabric of what feels like tremendous progress from my detached, elitist, white perch. And I often check myself and think, actually, you know, what's the real guiding star here? What are we actually shooting for? If we're shooting for genuine on the ground improvement, is this whole thing a bit of a game? Is it a bit of a wank? Or is it necessary to get things changed on the ground? What do you reckon?
I think it will facilitate change on the ground. I think, you know, it's difficult to I think it's difficult to argue against that. And again, just going back to the Coalition of Peaks, they say, the Coalition of Peaks say that, you know, some of the conversations they've had with governments have improved. The understanding of governments has improved since they started having regular meetings as part of the COAG or whatever it is. But again, this is all kind of small steps. I was just thinking as you were talking, like going back when I was, say, in primary school, you didn't see the Aboriginal flag flown anywhere, really. I grew up in a small town, mid-north coast of New South Wales. Knew that I was Aboriginal from, you know, I don't know, two, three, I don't know, as far back as my brain started working. So, you know, and in community as well. And we were always on the periphery, and we didn't see things like welcome to countries or flags or anything like that. Very much part of, if not that, you know, that great silence, or, you know, as it's described, were very much of the disappearing or the dispersal. And I think what improved, say, from that period through to the present is acknowledgement and recognition around our presence within that area. But sort of on my father's side, which is the non-Indigenous side of the family, some of those, that older crew and past now, but, you know, back in the 80s and that, they just didn't countenance the idea that Aboriginal people, you know, were present on any of that land area that they lived on. Mm. And I think I can look back now, back to home, to country, and that's changed. So that's an improvement. But you look at some of the issues that are plaguing even my own community up there, and, you know, they're the same as in remote and very remote communities, lack of housing, health disparities and stuff, they haven't been addressed. And that's, you know, 3 or 4 hours, probably 4.5 hours drive from Sydney. You don't even have to go that far. You can just
drive. You can stay in Sydney and you can see disparities.
You know, Mount Druitt, Blacktown, wherever, and see the same sorts of gross disparities there. So, yeah, look, you know, at least now, well, the other thing, like, at least now we're present, to finish that thought. The other thing, you know, not within my life, it was, you weren't allowed to be proud of being Aboriginal either. And this is just going back to the, you know, 80s, potentially the early 90s in some of these towns. These days it's kind of cool, you know, it's the fad. And I think Black Lives Matter had a bit to do with that. But there's so many people that want to identify as being, you know, Indigenous. And it wasn't cool when I was growing up. And I hear that quite a bit, actually. People in communities, so it wasn't cool, you know, back then. Anyway, potentially could be seen as an improvement, you know. But it's,
well, certainly, yeah.
You know, you go into some of these communities, and you know, one of my uncles died at, I think he was mid 60s, and that's just that shouldn't be allowed to happen. He had chronic diseases, and they were preventable, and he died, and that was, you know, in Port Macquarie, which, as I said, is not that far from Sydney. So,
no. Yep. Okay. Well, then, let's fast forward into the future. And since we've just talked about what today is like in comparison to the past, you know, we missed a generation of change after the Republic referendum you mentioned earlier. Let's assume this referendum passes, and we go one generation into the future, and we're in the middle of the 21st century. What's your best case scenario? Like, can you articulate the vision of the place that First Nations Australians hold in Australian national life that would be, you know, that where you would feel like, yeah, we did it?
Oh, it's difficult to look that far ahead. You know, when you're dealing with stuff as urgently in the present. I think, and this is just me personally, I think having, I mean, we kind of see more Aboriginal people, more Aboriginal parliamentarians, or parliamentarians that are of Aboriginal descent is probably an accurate way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that'll increase. I don't know. It's, like I said, it's really difficult for me to sort of cast that far forward. I'm 47 next year, I think. In Aboriginal years, I've got about probably 40, 50, 20 years left before I'm gone. So, and I'm an older father as well. They're the urgent things that I kind of think about. So I don't know about 30 years ahead, but I don't know, in 10 years, I'd like to see the average that I, you know, I'm going to live another 10 years so I can hang out with my kids a bit.
Hmm. Do you think of yourself as tracking the longevity of the median Indigenous Australian when in reality, isn't most of that reflective of access to healthcare, access to nutrition, other social ills like addiction and living in remote areas of Australia and whatever that is?
Well, that's right. Yeah. This, that's the complex.
But by which I mean you're not subject to those factors.
Well, intergenerationally and transgenerationally, I am. So my health isn't great because the housing that my parents or my mother had when I was young, was in a position that in location that exposed me to some stuff that affected my respiratory and development and stuff like that because. Mm. Could not afford and was not allowed to live in other areas, that could have prevented exposure to those things. So I was. But many of those measures, affect people, Aboriginal people in urban areas. These things are not isolated to, remote and very remote communities.
Mm. It's impossible to predict. It's such a big thing to get our arms around. Thanks for breaking it down for us, Jack. It's useful. What's your general sense of where the nation's mood is around the referendum? Lastly,
well, this is what it's been doing all day, all month. Look, the polls suggest the commercial polls. I'm talking about the ones that the newspapers are reporting on. There's been the steady decline in people that are supporting it as the no creeps up. Speaking with some of the people that are involved in Yes to Three and Uluru Dialogue, they're looking at a different set of polls, three polls in particular, and these three polls are squaring up in terms of support for it. So, and also undecideds, this has kind of entered in over the last month and into the discourse over the last month, that the undecideds, 30-40% out there are going to determine whether it gets up or not. So, look, if I was a betting man, which I am, and if there was a market on the referendum, which there probably is, but I haven't been able to find it yet. I would plonk money on the yes vote. You get good odds at the moment, and I reckon that there is more goodwill towards it out there that perhaps the mainstream media is not, not hearing from or not sampling. That's where I'd go.
Mm.
At the moment, though, for me, it's really just as I said earlier or mentioned earlier, some of the information warfare around it, the disinformation, just astonishing. We're seeing a lot of what we observed from afar in when Trump was getting around America. And Brexit, we've seen a lot of those kind of tactics being deployed over here. I just find that fascinating, but also quite alarming. And I just like there's a story down here where somebody used the assembly to distribute a fake letter in a rural sort of area. Just to stoke up that fear about Aboriginal people coming to take their backyards. And it's just like the sophistication and extent of that deception. It's real and it's happening. Yeah. And they're the sorts of things that, it's pretty rotten to see.
Yeah, I've seen one of those letters. I was visiting a friend in northern New South Wales, and they got a letter dropped of a thing saying that, you know, what everyone doesn't realise is that constitutionally, once the voice body is set up, that acts as a trigger of having acknowledged the sovereignty, or the original sovereignty of First Nations people, and that means that there will then be a High Court challenge which will abolish private property in Australia, because actually First Nations people own everything, which was recognised when the yes vote went through, and like, is this arcane constitutional argument? And I just have to believe that most people, the vast, vast majority of people, see those things and just go, well, that doesn't sound like it's very credible.
Yeah, well, I have to believe that as well, because it's pretty despairing. You know, I have fluctuating – it's been difficult. That's another thing that should – we should probably touch on. Aboriginal people, it's been a rough, it's been a rough couple of centuries, I suppose, but since just August last year to this point, it's been really tough. And, you know, as I go around talking with people, it's like, how are you doing? And it's just that really pointed sort of question or tone about how it's asked, because everyone knows this is a testing bloody time to be a blackfella. How are you holding up, sort of thing. I think, remember with the same-sex plebiscite and all of the scrapping, the rhetorical scrapping and political scrapping around that, on the other side, or even during, but, you know, in the assessment of how it went, there was a lot of that was horrible, and it was unnecessary, and, you know, shouldn't have been in a situation where, gender diverse, LGBTQ, all that sort of stuff became targeted by some of these opponents to the same-sex marriage. And it received some traction, or it received audience or whatever. I think because Aboriginal people are only, whatever it is, 2.8 or 3% or whatever it is at the moment, percent of the population, the scope of what we're carrying, what we're dealing with, has kind of been overlooked a fair bit, or it's been glided past. I hope at some point, someone kind of acknowledges that it hasn't been easy going at all for Aboriginal people, particularly over the last 12 months since the PM announced some detail around the referendum at Garma last year. A lot of it is avoidable, and it would be good if, Aboriginal people weren't being harmed in the process of this entire referendum proposal.
Jack, take care of yourself in all ways, not just personally and emotionally going through this time, but also professionally. Don't burn the candle at both ends quite too much, because it's going to get intense, and there's going to be a lot of, a lot going on over the next 4 weeks. I appreciate you taking the time. It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. And, we're in the shoot now. This is only one way to go, and it's towards October 14 for a journalist. And, I'd prefer to be doing other, lighthearted stories or, fun stories. But, this is a slog, and I'll looking forward to the other side.
Will you take a holiday in November?
Taking a holiday in October. pretty much once the, whatever it is, the Saturday's out of the way, I'm on a train headed up the coast. So looking forward to that. That's what's getting me through.
Good on you. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, mate. Catch you.